Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning, Waukesha. Good morning, Wisconsin. Good morning, America. I am delighted to be with you again this morning. This is our third show in the month of June. Jim Santel, Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. We're once again here in the studios of WAUK in downtown Waukesha. Beautiful downtown Waukesha today, and delighted that you have decided to spend some time with me and also with Connor here in our in production studio talking about the significant issues of the day. This is a weekend review of the important stories in law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Once again, I'm so pleased that you're spending some time with us in discussion of some very significant issues coming up and some things that have happened in the recent past. We've got a very aggressive agenda, and hoping that you will also spend some time calling in today at 844-967-2789. Pleased to be with my friend and colleague just a few moments ago, Don Paul Brown, in his program this morning talking about all good things happening in Waukesha. We're going to be chatting again about things happening in America, in our state of Wisconsin, and beyond. And so let me talk first about the syllabus for this morning, what our plan is for this hour and then the second hour as well. This morning we're going to begin, we're going to follow up on our first conversations in our first two shows talking about, the United States Supreme Court. You may recall well that in our first couple of shows, we chatted about guns, this case called Bruin coming out of New York. And we chatted also about the upcoming decision to be rendered by the United States Supreme Court in a case that likewise is going to change America, we suspect, and that case is Dobbs. We're going to be spending some time talking about the environment, chat about religion, and also talk about immigration in the second portion of our first hour this morning to fill you in on some additional cases likely to be decided as soon as perhaps this coming week, maybe in the weeks just ahead. And then the second hour, we're going to turn to the January 6th Commission, the committee that's looking right now at what happened at, around, before, and after January 6th. Do some big takeaways on those, and once again, inviting your calls not only on the Supreme Court case issues, but also on the importance of those hearings. What's ahead, what is behind, as we look forward and backward here in the United States of America and right here in the state of Wisconsin. Every morning I've been beginning our program by talking a little bit about history, things that have happened on the day that we're getting together to chat, to have these conversations. And today is no different, although today, rather than talking about a number of different things that happened, for example, on this day in history, on June 18th in the past, I'm going to talk about just one because it also is a good tease, if you will. It's a good invitation to our second hour as we're going to be chatting about the behavior, the conduct of a former administration, a former president in our nation's history. But I'm going to go back 50 years ago yesterday, and yes, indeed today, 50 years ago today, we were waking up to some news about a curious event that happened in Washington, D.C. Let me set this up for you and talk about what happened on June 17th and in particular June 18th as we began to discover as a nation a significant event that changed forever the course of American history. It was 50 years ago yesterday and 50 years ago today that a 24-year-old security guard, his name was Frank Wills, again, changed the arc of American history. About an hour earlier, about 2 a.m. or so, on Saturday, June 17th of 1972, Frank Wills, who was a security guard at a particularly significant building in Washington, D.C., noticed and dutifully removed a small piece of duct tape had been placed over the lock of a door that he was required to check on during the course of his reviews and his walking through this building. That was a part of his morning routine. He didn't make too much of it then. He thought maybe that duct tape was there because it was some vestige, the leftover of an effort to accomplish with speed and with ease some routine package delivery that early morning or maybe earlier in the evening. He reacted differently, very differently. When about 45 minutes later, he returned to that same spot, the same spot that he had been earlier, and discovered that someone had replaced, had put more tape on that very lock that he had previously been visiting, looking at, and removed the tape from. supposedly, according to his story and certainly the story of the police that morning, Wills appropriately, urgently called the police. It says something is wrong here. Something is very amiss. He had his security telephone at the main lobby of this building. Summon the police from the nearby second precinct. He perhaps knew them well because of his work as a security guard in this particular building. And upon their arrival, those law enforcement folks came upon Mr. Wills, talked with him about what he had found, and immediately began to shut down the power to the elevators in that building, locked all the doors to it to keep any early morning intruders from accomplishing an escape. While the police were there, while Wills was also with them, responding to this curious thing with the tape on the door locks. And so throughout the entire time of Wills' tenure as a police, a law enforcement person responsible for the safety of this building, there had been only one other instance that Wills could catalog was an attempted burglary. Any other significant event probably he didn't recall well, and his assignment was otherwise pretty sleepy, fairly routine. But this particular discovery that particular morning on June 17th and into June 18th changed his life, changed our lives. And Wills, along with these police officers, were accompanying each other as they went door to door, room to room throughout this building, and tried to figure out who was in the building, who was improperly there. While some of the aspects of the police report differ somewhat from place to place and reporter to report, the reality is that Wills had come across something very significant. He said this later on, when we turned the lights on to a particular room that they finally came upon in this building, one person, then two persons, then three persons came out and down the line. That was Frank Wills, early morning Saturday, June 17th, and then also into the 18th of the following day. To that stirring account of his attentive work that night with the other police officers, we add and we know now the names of the people who came out in this attempted burglary on that very early morning. And we know their names. We know they're a part of history now, not a good part of American history. Their names were Bernard Barker, Virgilio Gonzalez, Eugenio Martinez, James McCord, and Frank Sturgis. And you're probably getting a sense of what this is all about just by virtue of their names. Wills and the other law enforcement officers who were responding to all of them did a couple of things. They were taken into custody. That is the folks coming out of this particular room that they were in. And they confiscated from them a great deal of material, some products, some things that they were using. And that include a bugging device, some camera equipment, some film, lock picks, a series of numerically sequenced $100 bills, and all of that would become very significant in terms of what was about to happen. Wills quite literally changed the course of American history. We'll get back to exactly what he did in just a moment, but there's a story behind Wills as well. Wills, as a result of what happened that early morning, the day that followed 50 years ago, right now, Wills had asked his supervisors, he had been a good employee, and after his long-standing history, he sought a raise. He wanted a raise from his basic rate of $80 a week. Today would be about $500 or so, and that was regrettably denied. And so Wills left that security position and spent many years following in an unsuccessful pursuit of stable employment, quite frankly. And Wills confirmed that later on in his life. He spent some time in our nation's capital. He had a security job at Georgetown University. He went to some other southern cities and eventually the Bahama Islands as well. And ultimately, he relocated in North Augusta, South Carolina, where his mother was, his family was. He very lovingly, according to his own reports and those of his family members, lovingly cared for his mother following her suffering a disabling stroke. And through his early middle age, Wills planted and nurtured a very expansive home garden with his mother. He went to the local library to pursue his academic interests and sort of reveled in the quiet company of his cats. In 2000, right before that, he was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and Frank Wills died on September 27th of 2000 at the Medical College of Georgia in Augusta at the age of 52, much too young. But he did change. He did indeed change American history. on the occasion, the 20th anniversary of, yes, you know what I'm talking about, the 20th anniversary 50 years ago today, but on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of the abortive break-in, and yes, that's right, at the Watergate Complex on the shores of the Potomac River in Washington, D.C., Frank Wills said this. He said he would do it all over again. And when he was asked about his motivation, why he was doing what he was doing on that early morning and into the day of the 17th and 18th of June, he said, you know, that's like asking me if I'd rather be a white man or a black man. It was just a part of who I am, he said, just a part of destiny. Everybody tells me I'm some kind of hero, but I certainly don't have any hard evidence of that. I did what I was hired to do, but still feel a lot of folks don't give me the credit for what happened that night and didn't give me the chance to move forward. That was Frank Wills on the 20th anniversary of the Watergate break-in. And then we finish up this reference to history and our own American history, again, that changed a presidency, changed the course of our own national livelihood. New York Times offered perhaps the most eloquent description of Wills' role in American history in saying that eulogy was delivered by United States Representative James Mann. He was from the 4th Congressional District of South Carolina. Upon his vote as a member of the House Judiciary Committee to remove a sitting president, yes, we know that's Richard Nixon, a vote to remove him from office to return articles of impeachment for what turned out to be the Watergate scandal in 1972, 1973, and years that followed. And James Mann, in giving this most eloquent description of Will's role in American history, said this, "If there was no accountability, if there was no accountability," Mann said, "another president will be free to do as he chooses. Another president will be free to do as he chooses. But the next time," Mann said, "there may be no watchman in the night." History, history, making event 50 years ago, these days, right now. And so we hearken back to that time in our nation's history 50 years ago, the Watergate scandal and the things that happened. We're going to talk more about that in the second portion of our time together this morning. Right after the break, we're going to get back to the United States Supreme Court, talk about their activities coming up. We're taking your calls also at 844-967. This is WAUK in Waukesha, the Shaw, 540 AM, 101 FM. This is Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. And we're back. This is Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. It is Saturday, June 18th. Thank you so much for joining me for our program this morning. I'm here in the studios of WAUK Waukesha, WAUK Radio, right downtown Waukesha along beautiful Wisconsin Avenue this morning. I'm here with Connor, who's my producer. We're taking your calls as well during the course of this first hour and then also the second hour. Our syllabus today, as I indicated, is discussion more of the United States Supreme Court today. Additional cases they're going to be rendering probably this week and next week. And then our second hour chatting about January 6th. A good bookend, if you will, to our introduction this morning about what happened 50 years ago this weekend. This week, these days, the beginning of the Watergate scandal and the Watergate matter that toppled the president and changed our history. We'll talk about the extent to which those present events related to the January 6th insurrection and the riot at our Capitol will also change American history. It already plainly has. We're taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. So let's jump right back into our focus of the past several shows. Again this morning on Supreme Court cases. The United States Supreme Court continues to meet. This is its 2022 term. Its next term is going to be beginning in October. We're going to chat more about that at the end of this half hour or so. We have talked before in our first two shows of this month of June about two major cases that the Supreme Court is likely going to issue, could be as soon as this coming week, certainly in the following weeks, probably sometime in July, our additional cases coming out from our high court. And you may recall well, those of you who tuned in, that in our first show way back in early June, on June 4th, we talked about this case called Bruin coming out of New York and the possibility that the Supreme Court wrestling with Second Amendment issues, determining whether or not there was a constitutional right and a right under the Constitution of the United States of America to carry, perhaps concealed, perhaps open, on the streets of America, the sidewalks of America, a firearm, extending a case called Heller, decided 14 years ago, that established a constitutional right for every American to own and use a weapon in the privacy of her or his own home for the traditional use of self-defense. So that was Heller 14 years ago. The question we're waiting to hear from the Supreme Court on is whether that gets extended beyond the home into the streets and sidewalks, other public places of America. Likely the Supreme Court is going to expand that right, that vision, that view of the Second Amendment, but also indicate that there will be some appropriate limitations on place, secure places, places where we cannot have guns, places where people convene, schools, hospitals, other places of a common congregation, theaters, sporting venues, all sorts of places where it will be appropriately to impose regulations and conditions on the presence, certainly the use of firearms. Well, we're anticipating that Bruin case coming out soon. The second one we talked about in our second show was the one that perhaps the United States generally is focusing a huge amount of time on these days, and that is Dobbs, this case coming out of Mississippi, determining whether or not there is a continuing right under the Supreme Court past rulings in Roe versus Wade, a privacy right for women, and I would offer also men, to make decisions about reproductive rights. Is there a privacy right to an abortion in America? We recall well Roe versus Wade way back in 1973, a decision rendered by Harry Blackmun and majority of the Supreme Court at that time, finding that yes, indeed, privacy rights do give women the right to make that choice. And the question in Dobbs is whether or not the legislature in Mississippi that passed this 15-week prohibition on the abortion access, if that is consistent with Roe versus Wade. I think most people say it is not. And if it's not, is the Supreme Court about to overrule Roe versus Wade and establish some new principles under privacy doctrines, other ways of thinking about abortion as those issues play out? So we're anticipating both of those cases, and we've spent a lot of time chatting about those, and I appreciate your calls, your thoughts, even off air about those. This morning, in our remaining time, in our first hour, we're going to chat about three other things on the docket, the syllabus, if you will, also much before the Supreme Court these days, also coming out very, very soon. Let's chat about the first one of those. I'll give you a little sense of what's coming down the road. We're going to talk this morning about immigration and religion and the environment. So no small topics here this morning on Morning Cannolis. Let's talk first about this big environmental case. The name of the case, we're anticipating a decision from the Supreme Court. Write this down. Talk to your friends, your family members about it. It's called West Virginia versus EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. A major case pending before the justices. It could, in fact, redefine the federal government's power to regulate a main contributor to climate change. At issue fundamentally in this particular case is a dispute over the authority of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to address air pollutants from power plants. All right, the central question in West Virginia versus EPA is whether that agency's reach beyond the confines of plant size sites to encompass broader aspects of U.S. energy policy, whether that's appropriate. What is the extent of the agency's capacity, the executive branch's ability to issue rules under its established practices, especially when it comes to the area of greenhouse gases? And many of you may remember that President Obama issued something called the Clean Power Plan during the course of his tenure as our president, and it did in fact set goals for states to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from those power plants. There were a number of state challenges. You may also recall this much in the news a number of years ago, and ultimately the United States Supreme Court did temporarily, for a time, block the rule of the EPA that establishes these limitations and these goals for greenhouse gas emissions. President Trump, when he became the president, repealed that plan, and his position of his administration was that it exceeded the authority of the agency, this rulemaking authority, this administrative authority, to act in this area of environmental action and behavior and conduct. And so the President Trump and his administration supported and advanced a more lenient rule, kind of relaxing the things that President Obama had put in place. That executive decision was also challenged. And on the other side of the break, I'm going to talk with you about where that case stands right now and exactly what the Supreme Court's going to be telling us in the area of environment very, very soon. Come back, talk with us more about an environmental case, West Virginia versus an EPA, right here this morning on Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. And we're back. This is Jim Santel with you this morning. Thanks so much for joining me here on the air, WAUK Radio. It's 540 AM, 101 FM. We'll be taking your calls as well throughout the program this morning at 844-967-2789. In our first hour this morning, we're revisiting the work of the United States Supreme Court, anticipating major decisions coming out, perhaps as soon as the days just ahead, the coming business week, certainly the later weeks and days here in June, and probably also into July. We'll talk more about the schedule of the United States Supreme Court at the end of this particular hour. Right before the break, we're chatting about an additional case beyond the guns case, beyond the abortion case, which we have discussed previously. The case we're chatting about before the break was West Virginia versus Environmental Protection Agency. This determination about whether or not the original Obama Clean Power Plan that affected greenhouse gas emissions, whether that's legitimate, who's got the authority to impose rules through the EPA on these kinds of things. Lots of challenges going on there. And the questions before the United States Supreme Court are just those. Who can make these decisions? Should, in fact, the legislature, the United States Congress, principally be responsible for issuing and passing legislation that impacts greenhouse gases in the environment in particular? And in particular, does this rule, the Clean Power Plan rule by the EPA, does that pass muster? Is it legitimate? A challenge to that? As I said right before the break, the executive decision by President Trump to basically rescind the plan and impose his own lenient rule, that was challenged. And on President Trump's final day in office, a federal appeals court vacated that reversal, if you will. So lots of lawyer procedure going on in the case. But the Supreme Court, again, going to issue fairly soon a major case in the environmental area, West Virginia versus an EPA, plainly having to do with climate change. Watch that one as well. In the area of environment. Let's move on to yet another matter in the area of immigration. The justices are soon going to be issuing a decision over the Biden administration's break with, again, the Trump-era decision about immigration policy. How does this case come about? The case itself is called Biden versus Texas. And the history on this case is that President Trump instituted something called the Migrant Protection Protocols. You may recall this as the Remain in Mexico policy. The traditional practice although with a whole lot of exceptions and some particularities that we won't get into this morning, was and still is that if you apply for asylum, you're seeking asylum in our nation, escape from your own nation of origin because of a threat to you, your family, all sorts of categories. When you apply for asylum, one of the provisions is that you can, in fact, be here in the United States of America while the government authorities are passing on reviewing your asylum application. And so that was the policy, the rule for many, many years. During the Trump administration, the executive branch, the administration, implemented this migrant protection plan, sometimes called the Remain in Mexico policy. And you may remember this very well. The rule basically returned about 70,000 asylum-seeking migrants to Mexico while their applications were awaiting decision here in the United States of America. Lots and lots of coverage on this in the media, both national and international. When President Biden became the president, he rescinded that policy. Again, you see a strong pattern here this morning. Different administrations coming in on the environment and immigration, changing rules, changing administrative procedures here. President Biden comes in, rescinds the Remain in Mexico policy, based principally on human rights concerns. That's what he articulated at the time. Certainly things seen in the media as well, suggesting that there are human rights challenges by virtue of the safety and security of the people who are now even on the other side of the border, no longer getting the protection of our nation, even as their applications are pending. And so what happens is the states of Texas and Missouri sue in federal court. All these cases obviously percolating up through the trial courts, the federal appellate courts. They sued to enforce the protocol, which was the Trump administration plan, the Remain in Mexico policy, basically pushing back on the rescission of that policy, the return, the removal of that policy by President Biden. And they maintain that the problem with it is that it failed to follow something called the Administrative Procedures Act. The APA is common within all these areas. Anytime there's rulemaking going on, including the environment, including immigration, many, many areas of government practice and engagement, the APA prescribes the mechanisms by which executive branch agencies have got to announce rules, give all of us a chance to be heard on it, issue comments, have hearings on it. And it is often a practice of folks on all sides of the political aisle to attack decisions that they do not necessarily like based upon incomplete processes, inadequate, maybe even just plain wrong processes under the APA. So that's what's going on here in Biden versus Texas. Those who do not like the fact that President Trump rescinded the Remain in Mexico policy are maintaining that he did that without compliance with the APA. And that's what the Supreme Court has in front of it. Yes, this very technical kind of, again, lawyer-like approach on whether the APA applies. It certainly does. But what the implications of its application are for the particular Remain in Mexico policy, these migrant protection protocols at the focus of this. While that's kind of the narrow issue in front of the court right now, again, the larger issue is important for all of America, all of us. Here in the state of Wisconsin, throughout the Midwest, cities, villages, towns, all of us, I would offer in this area in particular, related to our relationship with nations throughout the planet, right across the globe, because it is an immigration issue, much like the other issue we discussed in the area of environment. West Virginia versus EPA also has an impact beyond just the United States of America. Biden versus Texas, the same kind of thing. And so the Supreme Court, yes, is going to issue an opinion in this very important immigration matter as well. Immigration, likewise, on its docket, talking with us about the extent to which the Remain in Mexico policy can, in fact, be rescinded, whether or not it still is has vitality to this day, and along the way giving us some fairly good definition about what immigration means in America today. So again, as we take some inventory of what we've talked about, we talked earlier about all these very, very high ticket, high visibility items: guns, abortion, environment, and immigration. And now we'll turn to yet a fifth area. And this one is also hot ticket. Reasonable people can and do, in fact, disagree on it. And it has to do with religion. Religion, under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, as we all know, as we've talked about before in previous times here on the show, the First Amendment, as you well know, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Other important aspects of that first article, the first member part of the Bill of Rights, also having to do with freedom of speech, freedom of press. The right of people to peaceably assemble, to petition government for redress of grievances. But this morning, our focus is on those first two aspects, the establishment of religion clause, the prohibiting the free exercise thereof clause. And what does that mean? A huge amount of litigation out there in the past, many, many cases at the Supreme Court level, at the appellate court level, the trial court level, interpreting that language written by James Madison and people like George Mason a couple hundred years ago. What does it mean today in America? And so, believe it or not, there are not one but two cases on religion pending right now in this term, the 2021-2022 term of the United States Supreme Court. It's going to define for us as we go forward what religion means in America today. What about establishment of religion? What about the free exercise clause? What do those concepts mean today? Do they conflict? And if so, which one takes precedence? Which one is supreme over the others? Let's talk about those two very important cases that are out there. One of them is called Carson versus Macon. Carson versus Macon is the case. It's one of two religion cases pending before the United States Supreme Court. In Maine, some students are lawfully permitted under state legislation to use state-allocated funds, your tax dollars in Maine, basically, to attend private schools. And why is that? Because in Maine, there are certain places, according to the legislature and the executive branch that's responsible for implementing all of this, there are certain places in Maine where public schools are simply inaccessible. I'm sure that that's the case in many situations around America. And so in Maine, students can use state-allocated funds to attend private schools if there are no public schools in their particular area. Right after this next break, we're going to talk about the implications of that as we go forward and chat more about Carson versus Macon in Maine, religion, and the importance of that issue. Come back, WAUK Radio, right here in Waukesha, Wisconsin. And we're back. This is Jim Santel, Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. I'm here in the studios of WAUK Radio in beautiful downtown Waukesha, right here along Wisconsin Avenue. And this morning we're chatting about additional cases before the United States Supreme Court. Things, issues, concerns, challenges that are going to implicate many, many aspects of our lives and our livelihood in the United States of America, not just now, but in the future. Right before the break, we were chatting about this case called Carson versus Macon coming out of Maine. Maine giving school-aged children the right to a free public education. But because many of the rural districts in Maine lack a public high school and other schools, a workaround was put in place that permitted those students to attend nearby qualifying private schools with public assistance, with public tax dollars. So where does the problem come in? Where does the challenge come in? Well, under Maine law, schools that offer religious instruction are ineligible. And the Maine authorities say the reason for that is that under the First Amendment, they would be establishing religion. religion as a government, if in fact they were to use your tax dollars to support religious education in Maine. This exclusion, sometimes called the sectarian exclusion, a policy that makes K through 12 schools with religious instruction ineligible for taxpayer-backed tuition aid. That's the basis for this challenge. The challenge is basically under Carson versus Macon. It was brought by Maine parents who say that barring their families' preferred schools from the tuition aid program based on religion does what? It violates their constitutional religious rights under the First Amendment. And their claim, their position is that under the related clause of the First Amendment, that the Maine authorities are affecting, are dampening, are taking away their free exercise right. And so you've got this challenge between the two phrases, the two clauses of the First Amendment, the Establishment Religion Clause, which the state of Maine is implicating and is bringing forth to justify its exclusion of private religious schools from the possibility of getting funding for school-aged children. And you've got the parents who say, gee, if you exclude me from that, you are violating my right to free exercise. And so that's what's before the Supreme Court right now. Which one of those? Can they be reconciled? Which one of those has precedence over the other? And does Maine win? Are they right in establishing or not establishing a religion and going forward in implementing and enforcing its law? Or are the parents right? Are the parents right in advocating for this notion that under their free exercise rights, under the first article of the Bill of Rights, they should have the right to have their students, their children, attend a private school, a religious school, using tax dollars? Not an easy case. We know that in 2020, there was a case called Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. And basically, the court at that time found that the state of Montana can't exclude religious schools from participation in a scholarship program. States have to allow religious schools to participate in programs that provide scholarships to students attending private schools. So in that particular case, the Supreme Court sided in favor of the religious interest and found that the government interest in not establishing religion was overcome, if you will, by the free exercise rights of those parents and those students, also raising a concern and a challenge under the First Amendment. So the name of that case, once again, Carson versus Macon. Carson versus Macon. And yet there's another case, a second case in the broad category of religion, and it's also pending for the Supreme Court right now. And this is one that you probably also saw in the news not too long ago. The facts on this case, problematically, are not entirely clear, and the Supreme Court justices at the time of the oral argument were sort of frustrated by this, did not have clarity on this, so it's entirely possible that they may send this back to the lower court for some clarification of exactly what happened and what didn't, or they may choose the facts that they think most compelling and reach a certain result. So what's the case all about? What is it called first? It's called Kennedy versus Bremerton, Bremerton School District. Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. And again, you may have seen a lot of this story on the news because it's one that we see virtually every week. High school sports for years and years. We've got a high school coach. He is in Seattle. And for many years, again, according to one version of the facts, after every single game, he prays. He prays at the 50-yard line of his football field. And, of course, we don't intrude into his individual prayer, but it follows games that his team has been playing in on the field. And everyone knows that the high school coach has been doing this over time. Over time, some of his players have joined him in that. First, a small number. And now, according to one set of the facts, the entire team now prays with him at the 50-yard line. And, of course, the high school coach maintains that his prayer, his decision to kneel down along the 50-yard line for a long period of time, this has been going on historically for many years, that he should have that right to do that because under, again, the first article, the first portion of the Bill of Rights, Article 1, he's got a right to the free exercise of his religion. And again, you should know under past precedent that the Supreme Court has said that indeed there is a right. There is a right under the First Amendment to the Constitution to exercise your religious faith, your religious views, free exercise of religion by doing what? You can pray in school. You can open up the Quran, the Bible, the Torah, and you can have private prayer if you would like. Obviously, appropriate circumstances, appropriate time and place for the instructions got to go on as well. But school prayer is not forbidden, but it's got to be individual. What I can't do, you can't have a teacher, you can't have the administration compel an entire class, for example, to open up the Bible, open up the Torah, the Quran, other books of spiritual inspiration. I can't have them pray as a group because that's, once again, institutionalizing inside the government, inside the school district, the notion of religion, and that would run afoul of the establishment of religion clause. We know that you can do it individually. Students can do that, and presumably teachers, and even a school coach can do that. The question is, when it becomes broader than that, when it is in fact more of a class, in this particular case kind of a team, how do those weigh out? Okay, so the high school teacher, the coach, he's initially reprimanded, eventually he is suspended from his Seattle teaching and coaching job there because they maintain that he has now run afoul of the establishment clause, and by having all of his team members on the field for his prayers, again, we're not quite certain about all the specific facts here, so we'll wait to see the Supreme Court's rendition of those as well, but under that particular set of facts, as I've described them, the question is whether or not the decision by the school district to suspend, to discipline him, is proper, whether it's a proper exercise of their obligations, if you will, under the first article, the First Amendment, establishing that there should be no establishment of religion by an institution like a school district, a school, or in the alternative, should there in fact be a recognition of the coach's position that he's got a right under the First Amendment to exercise his beliefs and pursue his religious beliefs by having prayer. And the mere fact that others join him, members of his team join him on the field, do not undercut, do not compromise in any way his right under the First Amendment to exercise his religious liberties. So again, the case is Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, very significant. What do you think? Call me, 844-967-2789. These are not easy issues. The other ones, obviously, much related to rulemaking, the environmental case, the West Virginia case, lots of rules there, Biden versus Texas under the APA. This one more fundamental to the Constitution. What are those phrases in the Constitution mean? What does establishment of religion mean in this context? Is the school district right, Bremerton School District, in terminating him for engaging in what he maintains is the exercise of his religion under Article 1? And again, we're taking your phone calls on that and any other issues at 844-967-2789. So we've got these three other major cases also being decided by the United States Supreme Court very soon, perhaps as soon as this coming week. Let me talk a little bit about what the Supreme Court has done and how they work and how we can perhaps begin to think about some prediction here. We know that the Supreme Court on a regular basis tells us those times when we do have cases coming up for decision. We knew that there were some decision days just this past week on Monday and again on Wednesday. The Supreme Court issued about six different opinions. They dismissed one case, issued some other opinions and in a case called Viking River Cruises having to do with contractual waivers. They made some decisions in a case called George versus McDonough, a Veterans Affairs case on benefits, another case on Medicare prescription drugs, reimbursement rates, a couple of other cases as well. Those issued just this past week. And we know that there'll be more cases coming up this coming week as well. Decision days on Tuesday, June 21, and again on Thursday, June 28. This Tuesday, this Thursday, more cases being decided by the United States Supreme Court. All the five we've talked about. Come back after the break. We're going to chat more about that and move on to January 6th. This is WAUK, Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel, taking your calls, 5:40 a.m., 101 FM.